According to the received narrative, we have entered a new geological era in the history of our planet, the Anthropocene. Human beings, so the theory goes, have become geological agents, having an impact on the planet so profound that it can only be compared to past ice ages and the early stages of the planet's formation. But this narrative implies that all humans have had a hand in changing the planet, and that all humans are affected in the same way by this change. Philosophers, historians, and geologists have recently been pointing out that this isn't the case. Climate change affects different groups of people differently, and the same goes for some of the proposed solutions to climate change. Desmond Tutu has spoken of a climate apartheid. Climate adaptation, he says, is becoming a euphemism for social injustice on a global scale. So what does the South African cleric and human rights activist mean when he compares some climate change solutions to the apartheid regime? What's the relationship between climate change and racism? And how can understanding the origins of both help us put forward solutions that don't reproduce the inequities of the past? Welcome to The Philosopher and the News. I am Alexis Papazoglou. This week, Nancy Twana, Professor of Philosophy, Women's, Gender and Sexuality Studies at Penn State College of the Liberal Arts, and author of several books and papers on feminism, climate change, and the nature of racism, talks to me about how to uncover the ethical values implicit in how we think about climate change, and why the history of racism and environmental disaster are deeply interconnected. Nancy Twana, welcome to the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start talking about a term that has been very influential in how we've come to understand climate change, namely the Anthropocene. And usually we think of it as referring to our planet's current geological period, one defined by anthropos, the human word in Greek for human. Could you tell us where this term originated from and what it has come to mean in the climate change discourse?
So the term actually originated at a conference in which there was an effort to think about the way in which our current human contributions, particularly to greenhouse gases, but in a variety of different ways, were actually changing the geological forces on Earth, that humans were, in the words of some scientists, becoming a geological force. The concept has shifted to some extent from that scientific conception, and it has started to get groups of people from the humanities, the social scientists, thinking about it in a more either metaphorical way or thinking about the implications of the claim that humans have become a geophysical force. So there have been a number of people who have been trying to theorize from the Anthropocene. That theorizing has gone in both directions. Some theorists see our inclusion in the more than human realm as a new way of starting to think about human interrelationality with the world. But on the more critical side, a number of people have been arguing that the anthropos of the Anthropocene is not universal, that those who have contributed to, say, if we're talking about climate change, increases in greenhouse gases, are not universal humans per se, but particular groups of humans and particular institutions like capitalism and colonialism. So the anthropos of the Anthropocene is under a lot of debate at this historical moment.
Yeah, this brings us neatly into an area that you've written a lot about, which is that often scientific terms which present themselves as merely descriptive are in fact value laden. they have implicit ethical commitments. There is an ethical outlook that is incorporated in those terms. And as you mentioned just now, in the Anthropocene, there's this question about, you know, who is the we, who is the Anthropos in this case. This became very prevalent during the pandemic as well. You know, one of the slogans that governments around the world enjoyed using was, "We're following the science," as a kind of argument for the validity of their policies. So you've looked at this issue through the lens of feminism in past work, and you emphasize this point that one of the roles of a feminist approach is to try and uncover the values implicit in climate change modeling, climate change decision making. How do you go about finding out what those implicit values are in, you know, a particular kind of scientific model or a scientific way of thinking about climate change?
So there's a variety of different ways to do it. I've worked, for example, with the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change documents. And one of the things I've looked at is the ways in which they've aggregated impacts. So that if you aggregate impacts, you're basically using a consequentialist framework rather than looking at arguably Rawlsian perspective of those that are least well off, the impacts of those that are least well off. So that we actually end up, I mean, one of the really fascinating things, I also work with climate scientists on the ways in which they model and the implicit inceptions in their models. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's really fascinating is that almost all of the scientific models for climate change are based on aggregate impacts. That's how they work. That's how the models work. Uh-huh. And that assumes a version of utilitarianism. But we can't assume that communities embrace a utilitarian framework.
Can we say a bit more about what that is exactly in this context? So looking at the consequences of a policy overall rather than particular how it will impact those particular people over there, we don't think about individuals or individual groups in that framework. Is that the difference?
So the difference is not only that when you aggregate impacts, you definitely look at all, for example, human beings, if that's the measure. And you just say, you know, if 100,000 are impacted, that's better than 100 million being impacted. So we'll choose the action that has negative impacts on the least number of people. But it doesn't look at the vulnerabilities of the particularly situated people. But in addition to that, it ignores other ethical frameworks. For example, we did interviews with actually a stakeholder group in Michigan of CEOs of businesses in Western Michigan. And when we talked to them about what they valued, they talked about what would be called a deontological or a rights-based approach and a duties-based approach. And what they kept saying to us was, it wasn't about just aggregate impacts. It was about what they owed their communities, that they were part of a community and they had certain obligations and certain duties to the people who lived in those communities. And they wanted to make their lives better. And that's very different than a consequentialist or utilitarian framework. Mm-hmm. And that's what the climate scientists are working with. And that's how the models work. So one of the things that I've been doing is working with a team of climate scientists to think about how we might model differently, not only model in ways that doesn't look at a global level, that can do downscaling to individual areas, but also might be able to represent these different types of value systems.
Really interesting, yeah, to think that the default, even implicitly framework that scientists use is a consequentialist one, even without them noticing. And of course, that, as you say, has consequences down the road. Another theoretical tool that you mention about how we might go uncovering the values implicit in our approaches to climate change is the concept of sensibilities. And you talk about sensibilities shape what we value, what we desire, and that they are what allow people to make sense of and be alert to certain practices, values, again, whilst, you know, ignoring or not really registering certain other values and practices. Can you say a little bit more about what you mean by sensibilities and give us an example of how a particular type of sensibility maybe might make us blind to some ethical issues that arise from climate change?
Sure, I'm happy to. And in particular, one of the things that I think is really important and what I'm working on is what I call genealogical sensibilities, where these are sensibilities that look at the way in which our current values and habits and dispositions emerged. For example, let's go back into the domain of climate change right now and climate impacts. There's been a lot of work recently, some lovely stories by National Public Television, National Public Radio in the U.S. on what's called urban heat islands. So one of the things we know from climate change is that aggregate temperatures, overall global temperatures are rising. And one of the consequences of that are heat waves. And we have been experiencing some of the hottest summers on record in the past decade. When you live in a city, there are what are called urban heat islands. And these are areas that are warmer than other parts of the city. Anywhere from 3 degrees Fahrenheit to, amazingly, 12 degrees Fahrenheit. So if you're in a heat wave and the temperature has risen above 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and you happen to live in an area that's a heat island, and these heat islands, by the way, are caused by absence of a lot of green spaces, parks, trees, a lot of built environment, asphalt, cement, et cetera. If you're living in one of these heat islands, you're experiencing much higher temperatures. Now, when you look at who is most likely in the U.S. to live in urban heat islands, it's the poor and predominantly minority populations. So when you try to deal with this question, one of the things I think is really important is to use genealogical sensibilities to think about why is that the case? Why is it that in many U.S. cities, the majority of the population in the areas that are going to be the most susceptible to heat waves are poor people of color? For that, you need to go back historically. And so National Public Radio and other studies have been looking at the way in which redlining practices in the United States, in which the government decided in terms of, and also loan agencies decided, which communities were safe enough to invest in. And communities that they thought were not a good risk were literally redlined. They draw a red line around those communities. And the decision variable for whether or not a community was reliable, was a good investment, was whether or not it included non-white individuals, how whiteness was defined at the time. So that's the beginning of how you go back and you think about how something comes into being based on what at that time, that was a sensibility at that time. Neighborhoods with Black or brown populations will lower interest rates. But go back even further than that. That's why genealogical sensibilities are valuable. And you see the ways in which, for example, in a city like Chicago, at the turn of the century, as we were coming into the 20th century, many neighborhoods in Chicago were what we now call mixed neighborhoods, where you had communities that were white, Black, brown. And white communities at that time decided that they didn't want that. And so Black and brown homes, people owned by people who were African American, and in some cases, Asian American, Jewish, and also in some cases, Latino, were bombed or were burned. And those people were subject to violence that resulted in them leaving the area. So the areas, those areas that, according to loans later in the mid-20th century, were seen as good investments, were made that way. And these were sensibilities at the time that were quite accepted, were supported by many people, were not enforced or, you know, limited by the government. So that's what I mean by applying genealogical sensibility, so that we start to get a sense of how this current situations and some of our views today got put into play.
Yeah, yeah. Understanding older sort of frameworks and older ways of thinking that might have not been necessarily explicit at the time, or people might not have been fully conscious at the time, but that their impact on how things developed is yeah, very explicit. Before we go into talking more about the relationship between climate change and race and racism, let's talk briefly about another part of your work, which is the gender differential impacts of climate change. And the idea there is that men and women are affected differently by environmental disaster, and specifically women are often sort of written out of the picture of climate change impact. So could you give us some examples of how that is, some kind of, so we really get some concrete understanding of how that differential occurs?
So there's been a lot of work by many theorists about primarily two areas. One is differential impacts based on gender around climate impacts. And the other is equal representation, or what would be called procedural justice, that for many years, when you went, for example, to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change,
it was all men.
It was all men. And one of the things that was argued was decisions about climate change, whether they be international or national or even regional, need to include representation from women. Now, mind you, if you engage in an intersectional perspective where it isn't just gender that's relevant, those women themselves also need to be diverse. So if you have only white women, you're not representing all of women.
Yeah, you lose some perspectives again. Yeah.
So there's procedural concerns, but the distributive concerns have a lot to do with, for example, how we understand the distribution of climate impacts. Many of the climate impacts that are taken really seriously are ones that have either lives are lost or have economic impacts or have damage to economic infrastructures. One of the things that feminists have been arguing is that we also have to think about the affective dimension of climate change, the way it impacts our well-being in terms of how we feel, not just whether or not we have our income.
Enough money, yeah. Not just thinking about the financial side, but also thinking about other aspects of life.
So one really interesting study of this was done by Margaret Alston in Australia. Australia had a series of really devastating droughts. And as a result of those droughts, the land that people were used to changed dramatically. And what she talked about was the ways in which, for example, for women, their gardens, which included both vegetable gardens and flower gardens, were just gone. They could not be sustained during this more than decade-long drought. And the women talked about extreme experiences of depression and feeling out of place, out of home, what one theorist has called solastalgia, feeling not at home when you are literally at home. But the impact for men of this same drought was very different, because many of the men were farmers, and many of those farmers lost their livelihood. They started losing money. The farms were starting to go under. And as a result, their responses were different in how they manifested from the women. Depression was the same. So there were high levels of depression in both men and women. But for men, men were much more likely to either A, commit suicide due to that depression, or B, there was an higher incidence of spousal abuse or partner abuse based on that depression. So it's really important to be able to take a look at how not just gender, but gender in a particular place is being affected by climate change.
Well, yeah, that's really interesting. And also, I imagine this kind of differential impact also has different political representation, right? Because we're more likely to take seriously concerns that are of an economic nature, say, than concerns that are of a psychological well-being nature. And so if someone says, well, my business has gone under, you know, the government might end up doing something about that, but less likely if it's something that is less concrete, as it were, or harder to quantify in some way.
And it's very important to have this knowledge when one is engaging in adaptation. So there's two facets of responses to climate change. One is mitigation, where we can try to emit less greenhouse gases or capture those that are being emitted. The other is adaptation, where we adapt to unavoided or unavoidable climate impacts. Let me give an example of an adaptation strategy that really backfired. And let me begin by saying, in many cases, people who are working on adaptation are very well-intentioned. They are really trying to help people who are being impacted by climate change. And I'm going to stay for a minute in Australia and that same drought. So groups of people were working with some of the indigenous population in Australia who were losing a lot of their food sources to the drought. And what they did was to get grants and introduce drought-resistant food plants that would help those communities weather the drought. Mm-hmm. Sounds good. Problem was, they substituted for crops that were in that community seen as women's crops, which meant that women received the income from those crops and could use them in any way they wanted to. They substituted for those crops that were seen as, quote, men's crops, which meant that the revenue went to the males, which meant that it often did not go back into the household. And as a result, women were finding themselves without enough money to feed their children and pay the bills they needed to pay. So you can see that a lack of knowledge of gender cultures, without even judging anything about the cultures, just knowing what the gender culture is crucial to good adaptation strategies.
You're listening to The Philosopher in the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. As always, this podcast is created in partnership with The Philosopher, the UK's longest-running public philosophy journal. Check out The Philosopher's website for upcoming events in April and May, including the one on May 3rd with Deepesh Chakrabarti, one of the most influential scholars grappling with the meaning of climate change, in conversation with philosopher and poet Travis Holloway, on Chakrabarti's latest book, The Climate History in a Planetary Age. Go to www.thephilosopher1923.org/events to register for this and many other events, including one hosted by yours truly. Okay, let's go into the main theme of our discussion, which is the relationship between climate change and race. And I'm thinking here in particular of a paper that you wrote called Climate Apartheid. So we talked about how in the case of gender differentials, there, you know, we can think about how climate change impacts men and women differently. And we can also talk about how climate change affects different races differently. And you say that a lot of approaches to environmental racism seem to focus on this sort of co-occurrence, as you call it, between different races being affected differently by climate change. But you argue that this isn't enough in the case of race and understanding the connection between the two, that we need to go beyond simply pointing out that different groups of people from different races are impacted differently by climate change. And instead, you argue, as you've already maybe hinted with your genealogical sensibilities approach, that there is an interconnection between systemic racism, the existence of racist institutions and practices, and environmental destruction. Can you explain to us a little bit about why you think this is the case and what is the connection here between systemic racism and environmental destruction?
Sure. And the connections are complex. Let me begin by saying that this type of work has to be done in a very localized, situated way. If you want, even if you want to understand differential impacts, you really have to look at, you can't look at them globally.
You have to look at the particulars.
In particulars, at particular situations, just like I just gave you the example of women's and men's crops. That's not true in all regions.
Sure, yeah.
So what I'm trying to do is argue that we need to expand our conception of either environmental racism or the differential impacts of climate change, to go to see that as very important and to recognize them when they happen, but to also understand that it's a piece of a bigger problem. And that bigger problem is the way in which systemic racism and what I call ecological indifference co-occur and actually are mutually supportive. So I look at a lot of different instances in which a disregard for the environment, seeing it as something that's consumable, disposable for our use, is harvested through the lives of individuals who, because of racism, are themselves seen as disposable, as in a sense, usable.
Yeah. So there's an exploitative mindset that applies to both cases.
That's right. And so, I mean, I'll give you some examples of this, but let me make one more link, which is when we were talking about sensibilities earlier, one of the underlying sensibilities that I'm working to critique is one that divides humans from the rest of the environment.
Great. I wanted to ask you about that. So, yeah.
And sees humans as somehow not part of environments. So there's humans and then there's environments, and we live in environments. And so the environment becomes that which we can use for our benefit, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the problem with this is it's not as clean cut as I just made it sound, because historically and currently, we see certain groups of people as less than fully human, as what might be called underdeveloped, undeveloped, less civilized, savage. And this has been a trope that's been used historically in a lot of different countries to justify actions of either genocide, as was the case both in Australia and in the United States, with large percentages of indigenous populations, or unfree labor practices like chattel slavery in the United States, Brazil, and a number of other countries.
Okay, let me try and understand this, because my question was going to be around something you critique when talking about the concept of the Anthropocene, which is that, it has this implicit distinction, this implicit dichotomy within it between humans and nature, or nature and culture. And as you just said, you see that sort of dichotomy as problematic. And you also argue that nature and culture are much more intertwined. In fact, you use a term nature culture as one word to indicate that. So, okay, two questions. One is, why do you think that this distinction doesn't hold? It seems like a common sense, maybe you know, a relic of an Enlightenment way of thinking about our place in the universe. You know, we have on the one side nature, and we see ourselves as somewhat standing outside of it. So, how do you see this distinction as kind of being less clear cut than that? And if we see it as less clear cut, aren't we in danger of losing sight of the specific sort of human role and responsibility in how we affect climate and the environment? If we end up blurring the distinction between human and nature, don't we end up just saying that, well, you know, this is just what's happening is just natural, it's a natural development, you know, there are lots of natural catastrophes, this is just one of them. How do we prevent ourselves from falling into that kind of way of thinking?
So I think a good place to start is to recognize that despite the dominance of, particularly in Western countries, of a human environment split, mm-hmm. it's hardly the only way in which people see the relationship. In fact, there are a lot of cultures that do not make a split like that, that don't see a split between humans and the environment. And mm-hmm. in the United States, where I do a lot of work, you might look, for example, at the work of Robin Kimmerer or Leanne Simpson, both writing from various indigenous perspectives from within the United States, or Melanie Harris, who develops a womanist perspective from an African-American spiritualist tradition, of ways in which that split is not part of the sensibility. And in those communities, what you have are conceptions of relationalities and kinship that give a different model and a different understanding of the place of humans within the broader world. I mean, we even struggle for language to talk about this because we're so habituated to seeing that split as an essential way of thinking about humans. In those cultures, there are lots of different ways in which mm-hmm. what you were referring to as, you know, right action, good action is understood. And it has to do with flourishing and proper relationality. So it's not as if we would somehow, everything would become, you know, the night in which all cows are black. There are still, and we can learn from other cultures about ways in which right relations and kinship relationships can lead to the flourishing of the entire, what I call more than human world, that includes humans, but isn't apart from them.
So we could still retain what we presumably want to retain, which is this concept of, you know, accountability or moral responsibility on our part by just thinking of it not as us standing outside of nature, but just as relating to the rest of nature in the wrong way, as it were, or not having the right kind of relationship to the rest of nature.
That's right. Of course, which we're already doing. I mean, mm-hmm. we're constantly in exchanges with the world we're part of. We don't live without other types of beings, including the ones that are part of our bodies. So that it's a different way of thinking about the world. And one that I think that, and here's where I have to be really careful, because I'm using it with a lowercase a, not the uppercase a, but Anthropocenean sensibilities might actually help us here, because we can look at the ways in which one of the things that discussions of the Anthropocene are doing is it is starting to question the divide between humans and the world, and seeing the ways in which how things happen as a result of those relations, and that those relations change us as much as they change other parts mm-hmm. of the environment. And so getting a sense of that, and getting a sense of the ways in which different communities have understood that relationality, might just be able to give us a different conception, not a geophysical conception, but a different conception of how we might live in this complex world of ours. And one in which we start to see that those of us who are committed to environmental activism need to be equally committed to blocking oppression in all of its manifestations, because they happen together.
Mm. This brings me maybe to a question that's related to this. The method that you employ in trying to appreciate this intertwined nature of racism and environmental destruction, you term intersectional approach. So can you tell us a little bit, without going into too much of the technical jargon here, what does that mean? What is an intersectional approach to this question?
Sure. I actually am building on the work of a number of Black feminist theorists, like Kimberly Crenshaw and Patricia Hill Collins, who recognize the way in which, if you talk about race separate from other aspects of oppression, or you try to talk about gender separate from other aspects of oppression, you occlude the way in which they actually happen together, so that you are unable to really understand and appreciate, for example, the experiences of Black women whose oppression comes from the intersection of both race oppression and gender oppression. What I do is build on that work by developing what I call an eco-intersectional perspective, because one of the things that I think is really important, an intersectional perspective looks at different forms of oppression of humans, but it doesn't look at the ways in which our attitudes towards the environment is also wrapped into that perspective. And you need that if you're really going to appreciate and understand life ways and life worlds, typically non-Western ones, but they exist within so-called Western world as well, that don't make a divide between nature and culture, or humans and environments.
Mm. Since you referenced the work of Black scholars on this, I'll ask something that I wasn't sure how to ask you. It's partly because I feel guilty for not having had a Black scholar to talk about this, even though we tried several times to book people, but our timetables never seemed to align. How do you think about this topic, being a white woman studying this intersectionality, as you call it, trying to incorporate perspectives from other races, other cultures, indigenous people? This is a question in the zeitgeist at the moment about our ability to, you know, occupy, as it were, the perspectives of others and try and understand them. How do you think about this, and how does philosophy enable us with its various tools to do research in that direction, even if, you know, we ourselves don't occupy those perspectives?
So I think that there are a lot of different responses to your question. One is the importance of learning from the scholarship and the experiences of people who are writing from those perspectives. Mm-hmm. Sandra Harding, quite a few years ago, actually a lot of years ago now, talked about starting research from the perspectives of those whose experiences were not dominant. And that's one of the ways in which we can start to engage the wonderful work of so many Black scholars, but not expect them to do all the work, that to read their work, to cite their work, to be respectful, and to look at the ways in which these intersections happen in very complex ways. So mine is simply a contribution to the work of a large community of people who are working to understand these really complex intersections, and to not back away from trying to understand simply because we're not so positioned. Mm-hmm. It was often the case in the early parts of the feminist movement, we kept expecting white women expected or asked Indigenous women or Black women or Latina women to teach us about their experiences. And the response was, you keep putting more work on us. You do the work.
Teach yourselves. Yeah.
That's a challenge we all have. And there's lots of really good scholarship out there. So it's a matter of taking the time, engaging it respectfully and carefully, and learning with and speaking not for, but speaking from the work of and learning from that work of those scholars. And we can all do it.
Yeah. I like what you said about not leaving all the work, as it were, to be done by those communities, and also taking those approaches seriously and those perspectives seriously. And, you know, even if it's harder for us to think through different perspectives, that it's work that needs to be done. Let's go to the title of your paper, Climate Apartheid. And it's a term that is borrowed from a different perspective. It's borrowed from Archbishop Desmond Tutu from South Africa, and one that you argue highlights this interconnection between racism and the unequal distribution of climate change effects. Can you say a little bit more about the metaphor, as it were, of apartheid when it comes to climate change?
It actually was Bishop Tutu's metaphor. He argued that in a way similar to what happened in South Africa with apartheid, that adaptation practices were actually resulting in the same type of apartheid, where those who were the least well-off, the poorer of the world, were actually getting harmed by the very adaptation practices that were designed to protect communities or individuals. So I take a look at one particular adaptation. I already talked today in this interview about one, and that was the cropping practices, crops for drought that were drought resistant. But another that I talk about happens in Lagos. There's a seawall that is under construction in order to protect the city. With sea level rise, all coastal cities are trying to figure out what to do. And seawalls and various barriers, levees, et cetera, are happening all over the world. I've also worked in New Orleans, but they're happening, you know, they're talking about it in New Orleans, in the Netherlands, in Venice, Florida. I mean, it's sea level rise is going to be a very serious problem. And so a lot of cities, coastal cities, are working on adaptations for protecting against storm surges. The real risk, sea level rise, of course, will cover land that wasn't previously covered. But the real risk are storm surges, because as the sea level rises and storms intensify, which is happening because of warmer ocean waters, you get a lot of damage from the storm surges. In Lagos, they're doing what they're doing in many other places, and they're building seawalls. And what I do is look at the way in which that seawall is done in a way that actually harms most those that are most vulnerable, those who are living in the area, who often are living on floating boats, and who are being removed. Literally, communities are being burned down. Sounds somewhat similar to what I was talking about in Chicago. And people are, these very poor people, often Indigenous groups, are being forced out of the area in order to build a seawall that will have on it housing that only the most wealthy in Nigeria can afford. So you have a situation in which you start to see the way racism starts to circulate. And I do work looking at how these populations became so poor. So I look at both internal and external, the internal and external slave trade, but I also look at the ways in which colonialism worked in this particular part of the country.
So this is the genealogical approach again, tracing the origins of contemporary situation.
And then I remind my readers that it's not only the people who are being impacted, it's the environment in general. So you have changes in water flows, you have various different land and water organisms being displaced by the seawall. And not to forget, as we all know, that seawalls don't stop the storm surges, they displace them. So if you live downstream from a seawall, so this is the debate that's happening right now in a seawall to protect New York City. It may protect Manhattan, but if you live downstream of that seawall, you're going to get hit more intensely than you would without the seawall. And that's true not only of humans, but of the various different life forms that live in that part of the country.
So this is what Desmond Tutu is referring to when he raises concerns about adaptation and adaptation to what, adaptation by who. He brings up all these questions. And he says, I'm quoting him here from your paper, that adaptation is becoming a euphemism for social injustice on a global scale. So, yeah, we can adapt and build up a seawall to protect our precious cities. But then, you know, someone else less important in the eyes of the people doing the adaptation faces the consequences. And yeah, is there a way of doing adaptation of that scale without merely displacing the consequences to some other community or some other part of the natural environment? Should we just, you know, lay off the adaptation strategies and focus more on mitigation? Is that one of the lessons of this kind of thinking?
Well, it is one of Tutu's suggestion. He's not saying lay off adaptation, but he's saying we really need to focus on mitigation, because ultimately mitigation is what is, you know, adaptation is a Band-Aid in a sense. It's a much needed Band-Aid, but we can't, you know, there are limits to adaptation. But in the meantime, I want to return to something I was talking about when I was talking about gender and climate change. Remember that one of the arguments is women need to be represented in all of the policy domains in order for it to be equitable. Well, that's true with adaptation decisions as well. And what we need are the people who are going to be involved to be there speaking in terms of their values and their concerns.
Okay, since we're sort of coming to the end of the discussion, I wanted to ask you a question that, you know, is maybe less philosophical, but what's your outlook on the future of climate change? Are you optimistic? Are you sad about it? There's a lot of literature written recently about how we need to prepare ourselves for mourning what's going to happen to the environment. You know, should we begin preparing ourselves psychologically for a catastrophe that will mean the irretrievable loss of certain environments as we have known them until today? Or is such an attitude also skewed by, you know, the whiteness of this debate, and given that many people around the world have already had to deal with the destruction of their native lands? How do you think about this kind of question looking into the future?
Well, I think the way you asked the question and your last part was very important. We need to recognize that this is nothing new. Groups of people have been facing catastrophes like this for hundreds of years, and we can probably learn from their experiences. But I think that we do need to prepare ourselves. And one of the ways in which we prepare ourselves is by learning strategies for becoming more resilient, for across the board, not just my family becoming more resilient or my nation becoming more resilient. One of the things I think is really important is we have to stop thinking about climate change from a nation-based perspective. Even though we have to work locally, we really have to think about this as something that's going to have impacts globally. And so one of the things I think is really important, and we're learning this to some extent, I hope we learn this lesson from the pandemic,
yeah.
You know, that something good can come from this really difficult situation, is that changes that are made that look small, like wearing masks, seems like a really small change, can have a big impact. We all need to pay attention to the fact that we are facing very difficult situations due to the combination of systemic oppression and environmental impacts, and not separate them out and think about the ways that we as individuals, as communities, can start to respond and live differently in ways that are more relational, more responsible, and not get caught in it's the end of the world, you know.
It's the apocalypse. We can't do anything about it.
Drink, dance, and be merry. There's a lot of work to do, and to think about it in terms of all life beings and developing that sensibility to continue our work, to believe that it's going to make a difference. I mean, that's one thing I think is really important. We can't get pessimistic here.
Right.
The work is hard and it needs to continue. And we all need to work in different ways. And we need to be self-reflexive about the work that we're doing. We're going to make mistakes, whether it be planting the wrong crops or whatever, but we need to learn from our mistakes rather than giving up and keep working at it. It's too important not to.
Great. An optimistic note at the end. I like that. What's one book that you would recommend to listeners on some of the issues we've been talking about today, the inequities of the Anthropocene, and especially when it comes to questions of race and climate change?
It's a very short book, and I think it's very provocative. I would read a book entitled Is Racism an Environmental Threat? By Gaston Higg. And it's a wonderful way of shifting our thought. He gives a positive answer to his question. To think about the way in which we can't tackle one side without tackling the other side. So another one, which is also a small book, not so easy to read, is Catherine Yusoff's A Billion Black Anthropocenes or None. She does a wonderful job of explaining why the way in which the geophysical epoch dividing sensibility really does not understand how racism has been implicated in every one of the so-called spikes that has been proposed as the, in a sense, start of the epoch of the Anthropocene.
Nancy Twana, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure.
This episode concludes our mini-series on philosophers on climate change. If you haven't listened to the previous three episodes, Why There Is No Solving Climate Change with Tom Brooks, On Planning the Green New Deal with Alex Douglas, and On the One Child Policy with Sarah Conley, look for them on your podcast feed or visit our website, newsphilosopher.buzzsprout.com. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, help us spread the word and leave us a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser. We'll be taking a short break over the next couple of weeks, but we'll be back in your feeds after that with more philosophers talking about the ideas behind the biggest news stories of our times. I'm Alexis Papazoglou, and this was The Philosopher and the News. Speak again soon.